If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I am your host, KMO, and this is episode number 534, The Roots of Division, with guest Keith Preston, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Monday, November 19th, 2018. In this episode of the podcast, I will play a conversation that I had on live radio yesterday with Keith Preston of AttackTheSystem.com. Keith has been a guest on the podcast and on the radio show before. And in fact, I think he is the person who's probably the most regular and frequent call-in guest to the radio show, with the possible exception of Douglas Lane. The conversation is pretty self-contained and doesn't require a whole lot of introduction, so here we go.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
Keith Preston, you are on the air.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
Alrighty, so I have asked you to call in so we can talk about politics and the social side of politics and the rather bitter divisions that have arisen and I would say ossified in our nation. I just came back a few weeks ago from Los Angeles, where I attended Politicon, the unconventional political convention. And I talked to a lot of people there, and the conversations that I had face-to-face with people were all very congenial, even when there were, you know, points of difference. But the conversations that played out in front of audiences on stage were bitter and mean-spirited and angry, and got a lot of people from the audience basically shouting or, you know, giving some sort of vocal assent or vocal objection to what I would call virtue signaling from both camps from the stage. And it was not encouraging, I'll say. So what do you think of the current political divide? Actually, before we get into that, let me just say, for people who have not heard you before, that you are a self-described pan-anarchist. What does that mean?
Well, it's a bit hard to describe in a single sentence or two, but I am interested in the full range of anti-authoritarian philosophies, anarchism, libertarianism, decentralism, anti-statism, things of that nature. I have a website called AttackTheSystem.com that's devoted to the discussion of some of these ideas and interacting with other philosophies as well. But much of my work involves the idea of advancing a critique of power, of systems of power, in the way that plenty of others have done in the past, you know, Noam Chomsky, George Orwell, thinkers of that vague, of that notion.
And there are a lot of different types of anarchists in the world, and it seems that the people that the anarchists most like to argue with are other anarchists.
Yeah, I think if you got 200 anarchists in a meeting hall and asked them to provide a definition of anarchism, you would probably end up with about 500 definitions before it was all done.
So that's nothing new for anarchists, but I think the tribal allegiances and the outright anger and for the other side has reached in the United States. What do you make of that?
Well, that's actually borne out by statistical data. Research has been done on that shows that the division, the level of division between Democrats and Republicans, just on the basis of party affiliation, is now the widest that it has been at any point since the post-Civil War era in the late 19th century, after Democrats and Republicans had been shooting at each other. And at no point even in the 20th century was some of the divisiveness that existed during that time period, for example, the time of the labor movement in the early to mid-20th century, or the Vietnam and civil rights era in the 60s and 70s. At that point, the level of division was not nearly as wide as it is now. In some ways, it may have been more intense than other ways, but you didn't really see the kind of partisan divide that we have at the present time. Some of the other research that's been done on this shows that political affiliation is now a much more divisive factor than either race or social class or religion or gender. More Americans have said in recent surveys that they would more object to their son or daughter marrying someone of the other party than they would somebody of another race or another religion. So that's how divisive the party affiliation and, by extension, liberal and conservative and all of that are today.
Well, what do you make of that? What do you think is behind it? What's it leading toward? What should we know about that? Or what hidden dimensions are there that aren't really apparent at the surface?
Well, that's really several questions in one. First of all, we have to consider that there is a wide range of people that are not caught up in this kind of divisiveness. That's very important to recognize. In the Donald Trump-Hillary Clinton election in 2016, a bare majority of eligible voters even voted at all. Something like 54% of voters actually voted. So meaning that other people, about 46% of eligible voters did not have enough of an opinion in the election to actually vote. That was true in this recent midterm election as well. Only 49% of eligible voters actually turned out. Now, that was actually a very high number. It was the highest number in terms of voter turnout in a midterm election since 1970, almost half a century. But it still wasn't a majority. So we have to consider that there's still a lot of people that are indifferent to all of this. And if we want to break it down on the basis of political affiliation, there was an interesting study that was published last month by an organization that's based in the United Kingdom called More in Common. And More in Common studies political conflict around the world. And they actually did a study of political conflict in the United States, and they said that the American public can essentially be broken down into about seven major political tribes. They call them political tribes. What they call progressives, hardcore progressives, were only about 8% of the general population, whereas devoted conservatives were only about 6%. And then there's another group that they call traditional conservatives that were something like 19%. But there were four other groups: traditional liberals, passive liberals, that is people with generally liberal leaning views, moderates, and the politically disengaged. All of these tendencies collectively amount to about 2/3 of the general U.S. public. And this is what they labeled an exhausted majority that's not really that interested in all of these kinds of partisan battles. So we have to consider that. We have to consider there's a large number of people out there that aren't motivated by these kinds of things. A study was done by Real Clear Politics, the website recently as well, that compiles political data, and they found very similar things. They had very similar findings. But as to what the source of all this is, I think that there's multiple things that contribute to it, but it has to do with just the wider pattern of generational change, cultural change, economic change, technological change, and demographic change that has been taking place in the United States for really about half a century now. We are starting to see, for example, that the generation that came out of the 60s and 70s generation is now essentially the dominant generation. Those are old people now, and they're late middle age and elderly people. We're starting to see that technology has fueled a lot of changes in many different levels. One is simply communications technology. It used to be we only had three television networks. Now we've got multiple television networks that cater to their own political niches. We've got Fox for conservatives and MSNBC for liberals and some others for the people that are more in the middle. We've got the internet, and we've got social media and all these Facebook groups and Twitter accounts for people with opinionated views, and people can start their own websites, and we have websites that cater to all these political niches as well, everything from Think Progress and Huffington Post to Town Hall to redstate.com, all of that. Another thing is that we've seen class divisions widen considerably in terms of the overall distribution of wealth in the society. That's actually the widest it's been at any point since the Great Depression era, since about the 1920s. Technology has fueled that in terms of things like automation and outsourcing and all of these other kinds of things. We see social mores changing rapidly, things like gay marriage and all of that becoming more recognized and acceptable, and now transgenderism. And so we see all of these different kinds of changes taking place in society, and I think that these divisions are taking place among the elite as well as on the ground level. I think within the ranks of the elite, we're starting to see a lot of conflict between what we might call the traditional elite. And the traditional American elite are the standard big business, big banking, big oil, country club, you know, agribusiness type of elites. That's the traditional elite in the United States. And that I think is being challenged by the rise of a new elite that is rooted in newer and more high-tech industries. The technology industry is a big example, but there are others. You know, if we wanted to break it down, we could say it's basically a matter of the country club and chamber of commerce types on one side, and then stuff like Hollywood, Silicon Valley, Madison Avenue, the public relations industry. The ideas industry generally, that is education and journalism and all of that, on the other side. I think we see a big divide among the elite in this regard. We're also starting to see the rise of elites within the traditional outgroups. We're starting to see more and more, say, African Americans and women and gay people and people of other minority ethnic backgrounds who are assuming leadership positions or positions of influence in different ways. And so we're seeing all of these different kinds of changes happening, that's happening at the top level as well as on the ground level. And then I think that what elite constituencies are doing, various elite factions, the political parties and the kinds of elite interests that they represent, they are obviously trying to build constituencies for themselves. What in political science terminology is called a base. We always hear the conventional political analysts talk about the base of the Republican Party or the base of the Democratic Party. Well, that's a term that refers to, you know, constituents who are loyal constituents and hardcore voters for one of the parties and things like that. One thing that I think has been going on for decades, and we're starting to see the impact of this now, is that I think both parties have consistently for years tried to build a base for themselves by reaching out to the far fringes, wider culture. It used to be that the Democrats and Republicans tended to be essentially centrist parties, and each party had liberals, conservatives, and moderates within the party. And then the differences between the parties tended to represent more regional differences to some degree and also some class differences. You know, I recently heard Tucker Carlson from Fox News joke that in the past, it was always considered, well, the Republicans were the party of the country clubbers. And he said, well, we always denied that, but yes, we were. You know, and likewise, the Democrats were associated with unions and stuff like that. And then there were regional differences, north and south and east and west and all of that. But what we've started to see more and more is the parties reach out to the cultural fringes. Now, I think this is something that started actually back in the 60s and 70s. In the early 70s, the new left, the anti-war people and civil rights people and all of that from the 60s, went into the Democratic Party and essentially took over the apparatus of the party and moved the Democratic Party to the left, considerably to the left from what it had been in the 70s and 80s, which actually proved to be an electoral disaster for the Democrats. They lost the 1972 presidential election by a landslide. They lost the 1984 presidential election by a landslide. That was an electoral disaster for the Democrats. In the 1990s, the Bill Clinton Democrats came along with a new strategy. Well, what they did was they actually moved the party to the right on a range of issues, economic issues, foreign policy issues, law and order issues, but they kept a generally liberal approach to social issues like abortion and gay rights and things of that nature. The Republicans have done something similar, I think, going all the way back to the 1960s with Richard Nixon. In the 60s, the Democrats became the party of civil rights, and previously the Democrats had been the dominant party in the southern states among southern whites. But when the Democrats embraced the civil rights paradigm, they essentially lost the votes of southern conservative whites. And the Nixon campaign in the 1968 went out of its way to reach southern conservative white people. They call it the Southern Strategy. And they've largely pursued a similar strategy ever since. They did the same thing again in the 1970s and 80s when they started courting the religious right, that is, people with, you know, not as much conservative views on race as much as on religion and culture and sexuality and things like that, although there was overlap on all of those issues. So for years, the Republicans have tried to reach out to the, you know, the far right social and cultural constituent groups, that is, unreconstructed racists, the religious right, religious fundamentalists, the anti-abortion movement, the anti-gay rights movement, all these different kinds of things. And the Democrats have also reached out further and further to the left, where, you know, embracing things like transgenderism and all of these other ideas, these you know, left-oriented issues that have emerged in more recent decades. And this has created an extreme polarization between the two parties on a cultural level. And you have the two parties viewing each other as, you know, essentially existential enemies. And certainly their constituencies think of that way. Like, I know a while back I was having a conversation with somebody that I know that is a very loyal partisan for one of the two parties. And I said, yeah, it seems to me that the way that the parties view themselves and the way their constituencies view themselves is like, it's like the other side is an enemy nation or an enemy country. And this person said, yeah, that's kind of how I think of it. And I've seen that from both ends. You know, I've seen that from both ends. I know plenty of people who are on both sides of that, and I see that coming from both directions. So really what we are seeing, I think, is a conflict that's going on within the elite that has a trickle-down effect, where both sides are trying to build constituencies from themselves by reaching out to the cultural margins and by creating a base of hardcore ideologues in both camps.
Something that I have encountered, particularly online in places like Twitter, is that for somebody at the extreme end of either the left or the right, the group that is the most hated and the most despised are the moderates, the people in the middle, not the extremists in the other camp, but the people who just don't seem to have a whole lot of conviction.
Well, that you find that among radicals generally. That's nothing new. Back in the day of the communist movement, when the communist movement was growing internationally, it was often joked that the communists hated labor leaders and social democrats worse than they hated actual capitalists. We're seeing that now on both sides as well. On the Republican side, for example, you have the hardcore conservatives, the Trump voters and all of that, who despise what they call the RINOs, R-I-N-Os, the Republicans in name only. And by that they mean moderate Republicans that they consider to be too liberal or essentially just Democrats under another name. And we're seeing a lot of that now among the Democrats as well. You have a big conflict among the what are commonly called the corporate Democrats, which are the Hillary Clinton types and the Nancy Pelosi types, versus the left, which is the Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez left and all of that. That's a big split that's happening among the among the Democrats now. So, it looks like that there's this massive division between the parties, which reflects a wider cultural and socioeconomic divide. You're starting to see the same thing happening within the parties themselves, and that's not new either. In the 2016 election, I started to notice that just like the parties were splitting along cultural lines with each other, within the parties you started to see a lot of splintering that I think was as much class-based as anything else. I noticed that Donald Trump tended to be more popular among working to middle-class Republican voters, whereas some of the others, like Jeb Bush or whomever, tended to be more popular among the more affluent and upper-class Republican voters. And that was true on the Democratic side. The Hillary Clinton tended to be more popular among the corporate Democrats, the more affluent upper-class and affluent Democrats, whereas the more working-class Democrats tended to be more sympathetic to Bernie Sanders. And there was now with the Democrats, there's also the identity politics issue. That's something that was divisive among the Democrats, because a lot of the identity politics people also supported Hillary, whom they viewed as more sympathetic to their own interests. Although Bernie Sanders was eventually able to bring a lot of that into his own camp as well, the Black Lives Matter movement and some of that. But all of these things, I think, represent wider subdivisions that are taking place in the society, along with this big major division, this red-blue division.
I think a lot of people who had never heard of Antifa before, say, a year or two ago, are hearing a lot more about them. And one of Antifa's slogans is that liberals get the bullet, too. I know that you've got a fairly long history with Antifa. Would you say something about that group?
Yeah, Antifa or Antifa, however you want to pronounce it, there are multiple pronunciations. The term is just an abbreviation for anti-fascist. And this is a movement that, on one hand, they claim their roots in the anti-fascist movement that actually existed in the era when fascism was a real movement in the pre-World War II period. But in reality, the anti-fascists in their current form emerged largely in the 1980s, in part due to the rise of the skinhead culture of the time. In the 1980s, you had the rise of this neo-Nazi skinhead culture, and you had the other groups that emerged as sort of like the anti-skinheads, including rival skinhead groups. Like, there used to be a lot of rivalry between skinhead gangs of different types. Some were racists and white supremacists, some were not. But a lot of the modern Antifa movement seems to have its roots in that. And it's also grown over time and become a kind of youth subculture. Antifa's, it draws some from left-wing anarchists. It draws some from communists and other self-identified socialists or Marxists or whatever. Or a lot of Antifa just seem to be people that don't identify with anything. They just like to fight and things like that. But their general idea is that there should be no platform for fascists. That's their favorite slogan. And what that means is that anybody that they consider to be a fascist, which is pretty much anybody that has right-of-center political views or even left-of-center, but not as far left as they fancy themselves as being, anyone like that should be, say, barred from speaking in public and subject to public harassment and things like that. We've seen some recent examples of that. One was the incident at Tucker Carlson's house, whom I mentioned earlier. The group of these people actually went and staged a demonstration at Tucker Carlson's residence, and they were knocking on his door and spray painting his driveway and things like that. And they've done this in a lot of other contexts as well. Whenever somebody that's called controversial speaker from the right, someone like, say, Ben Shapiro or Milo Yiannopoulos or Charles Murray speaks on a college campus, they'll stage a riot. And they've also gotten involved in street fights with right-wing groups like the Proud Boys and the alt-right and the Patriot Prayer and all of this kind of stuff. But the I'd say that the Antifa are best described as a leftist vigilante group, and their purpose is to go out and use violence and intimidation and of a extra-legal nature in order to essentially keep voices that they consider to be too right-wing or too conservative or too fascistic or whatever from being heard. And again, they use these terms very broadly and very loosely. And like many hard leftists, they consider liberals to be their enemy as well, because they think that liberals are too compromising or that liberals are too tolerant of free speech and things like that. For example, you'll have liberals who say that, there shouldn't be harassment of public figures in restaurants, or you shouldn't go to someone's house and vandalize their house, or all of these other kinds of things, or you shouldn't get into violent street fights with people and attack people with truncheons and sticks and things like that. those, you know, liberals will criticize some of this kind of conduct that you see going on with the Antifa. And then, of course, the Antifa will come back and say, well, liberals are just sellouts and traitors, and they're collaborating with the enemy, and they're aiding and abetting the enemy. So that's why they'll say something like, the liberals get the bullet, too. Although, in reality, the Antifa are very, very poor street fighters. Virtually every action I've ever seen them involved in, where they got into a real confrontation, they always lost. There was one incident in California a couple of years ago where there was a group of 30 neo-Nazis and other far-right types gathering in Sacramento, and about 200 of these Antifa people got into a confrontation with this group. And there were multiple stabbings, but most of the casualties, most of the people who were stabbed, no one actually died, but there were injuries due to stabbings. And there were virtually everyone, I think, except one person that was stabbed was actually an Antifa. So this was a group that, you know, couldn't win a fight when they were when they had the opponents outnumbered something like 200-30. So, you know, very terrible fighters, but, you know, but they do favor this kind of aggressive, vigilante kind of action.
I've noticed they've been very active in Portland, Oregon recently. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, well, that's because Portland is just a center for radical leftist activity. The West Coast area, particularly the Northwest, the college towns on the West Coast, I think, are centers for radical political activity. There's this image that, like a lot of people on the right call it the Left Coast, but if you actually look at a breakdown of the electoral map on the West Coast, you see that the blue areas are the actual coastal areas in California, and the larger cities on the West Coast, like, say, Seattle and Portland and places like that, there's a lot of red territory among the rural areas and inland areas. But in some of those places, you have a lot of college towns or college cities or whatever, where you have large universities and other kinds of institutions that attract a lot of left-leaning people and a lot of left activist-type people and all of that. In Portland in particular, you have Portland State University, which is kind of like the, you know, Oregon's version of UC Berkeley or something like that. So in these kinds of atmospheres, you start to see the growth of a far-left subculture that engages in a lot of far-left type of activism. Portland right now is a hotbed for this kind of stuff. Seattle has a lot of this. For example, the Trotskyite was actually elected to the city council in Seattle. Of course, there's places like Berkeley and all of that, San Francisco, the Bay Area generally. But that's been one of their havens for activism. And of course, there's been other groups that have come along and tried to get into a confrontation with them. I know in recent times, I think some of these other groups, like the Proud Boys and the Patriot Prayer and some others, tried to get into some confrontations with the Antifa, and that happened last year in Berkeley as well. There was a big fight in Berkeley. That was before the Charlottesville incident happened. Charlottesville actually is while we're on this topic, is also a type of college town that's got a left subculture to it. But that's the reason, though, why these people tend to congregate in those areas. It's because of the universities are typically there that are left-leaning universities and attract a lot of students and a lot of peripheral people that are into this kind of politics.
You are listening to Sea Realm Radio. I'm your host, KMO, and I'm speaking with Keith Preston of AttackTheSystem.com. We're talking about politics and political divisions within the United States. Keith, we just had a midterm election, and I think for a midterm election, voter turnout was pretty high. The Democrats, or the Blue Tribe, were calling for a blue wave, and the Democrats did take the House of Representatives, although from my experience, it is quite normal for the midterm election after the election of a new president to go to the other party. So it doesn't seem all that remarkable to me, but what do you make of the midterm and the results?
Well, it's interesting how both parties are trying to claim victory in the midterm elections, and I think that both sides are right up to a point in the sense that there wasn't a blue wave. That wasn't the case at all. But the Democrats didn't do nearly as well as they were hoping they would do. They did manage to take the House, which, as you said, is not that unusual in a midterm election. They also flipped the governor seats in a number of states, and they also flipped the state legislatures in a number of states as well. So that is significant. At the same time, there were some significant races where they also lost. They lost the gubernatorial race in Georgia and in Florida, which were important races that they did not win. Although I would say, as far as the sum total of all of that goes, I would say that the Democrats did come out ahead for a lot of reasons. Just the reasons I just gave, as well as the fact that more further left-leaning Democrats, a number of those were elected in a number of places. The number of women that are going to be in the House of Representatives now is going to be at an all-time high. We're starting to also see more diversity in terms of Democratic Party candidates, including successful candidates. For example, I think in one of the states elected a Native American woman who was also a lesbian as their governor, and all of these kinds of things. So we're seeing a lot of expansion of diversity, I guess, on the Democrat side. And in terms of capturing new offices and things like that, the Democrats did pick up quite a bit. The main area where the Democrats did not do well was in the Senate, but the Senate has always been a very conservative institution. It's one of the more conservative institutions in American society, and it doesn't change hands between parties nearly as easily. So that's to be expected. But when we talk about elections, though, the main thing that we have to look at is overall demographic trends, which do tend to favor the Democrats. If we look at who actually votes for the parties, what we see is that the predominant Republican constituencies tend to be middle-aged to elderly white Christians in the rural and smaller town areas and in the southern and midwestern states. Now, that we can go overboard with that stereotype, certainly, because there are certainly minorities that vote Republican. There are younger people who vote Republican and all of that, and people from different class levels. But we do see that in the future, the Republicans are going to have a serious demographic problem as their constituency, their main constituency, either starts to shrink in size or simply die out. On the other hand, the Democrats, as they often like to point out, are the coalition of the ascendant, in that they do tend to represent groups that are rising in society, not only ethnic groups and gender groups and all of that, but also economic groups like the technology industry and all these other kinds of things. They do represent forces that are growing and rising in influence. So I think that's really the main issue there is, what are the demographic trends and what do those indicate for the future? Now, that can change, certainly. For instance, the Republicans could somehow come up with a way to get more minority voters. Last time, for example, the Rust Belt states went to the Republicans. That if they're able to hold on to that, that will certainly be very significant and very much to their advantage. I have noticed that the number of people, the number of African Americans, the number of Hispanic people or Muslim Americans or whatever who vote Republican is starting to increase slightly on the margins. And we're starting to see more, political candidates from some of the minority demographics on the Republican side in a very limited way. So it's possible that the Republicans could experience growth in that area as well. But right now, the Democrats have the demographic advantage.
You mentioned that the Democrats they represent the ascendant demographics. And it occurs to me that a lot of people who like Donald Trump they're attracted to his celebrity and to his personality, and their interest in politics is largely tied to him. And when he leaves the scene, be it in 2 or 6 years, they are unlikely to transfer their interest to some other Republican. That they might just be very temporary participants in the democratic process here in the United States.
Well, I think that's quite likely. But we also have to remember that Donald Trump is not that popular. in the 2016 election, there was actually a fairly low voter turnout, like for both parties. Both parties actually had a lower turnout than they had in both of the Obama elections. So it's not like people were coming out to stuff the ballot box for either Trump or Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump, of course, also lost the popular vote in that election. He only won the electoral vote. So it's not like Donald Trump is an overwhelmingly popular president. And I think there is something to the idea that it was Donald Trump's style, per se, that attracted a lot of voters, who, including people who otherwise would not have voted. Of course, now there's always going to be people who simply vote for their party, no matter who the candidate is. You know, that the so-called Republican base would have voted for the Republicans irrespective of who the candidate was. It could have been Scott Walker. It could have been Jeb Bush. It could have been Rand Paul. It could have been Ben Carson. It wouldn't have mattered. I don't think any of those figures really did have quite the appeal, or would in the future have the appeal of Trump for purely stylistic reasons. So it's quite possible that unless someone in the Trump vein comes along as a Republican candidate in the future, that may very well be correct, that Trumpism may just be a flash in the pan.
On the Democrat side, I think that a lot of people are investing hope in figures like Kamala Harris and who's the fellow in New York?
Bill de Blasio?
No, Cory Booker.
Okay. He's in New Jersey.
Is he? Okay. Yeah. East Coaster, though. And because they are young, they're fairly dynamic, they are people of color. In Harris's case, she's a woman. But Kamala Harris is a former prosecutor, you know, a real law and order type. And Cory Booker has a long history with, you know, finance capitalism. He is not, by any stretch, you know, anti-capitalist. And it seems to me that they're figures which have the most appeal, you know, particularly demographic appeal, are really very, very conservative on a fiscal level. And I think a lot of Democrats, particularly younger Democrats, are just not going to go for that.
Well, I think that's definitely an issue within that party, within the Democratic Party, because ultimately who gets chosen as their presidential candidate is dependent upon how well they do in the primaries and things like that. That's before you get to the general election. So the split that I was talking about earlier that's taking place among the Democrats, among the more corporate Democrats, like the figures you mentioned, for instance, Kamala Harris has a virtually identical politics to those of Hillary Clinton. I mean, the two are practically interchangeable. And Cory Booker is likewise a corporate Democrat. But it's quite possible that there could be an insurgency within the Democratic Party where they actually nominate somebody further to the left as their candidate, a presidential candidate. The big issue, though, is whether that will sell in a general election. There's different ways of looking at that. On one hand, when the Democrats have moved far to the left in the past, it generally has not helped them a lot. When they nominated George McGovern as their candidate in 1972, they only won one state. They won Massachusetts, which was the most liberal state in the nation at the time. McGovern even lost his home state. The same thing happened in 1984 when they had Walter Mondale, who was perceived as being far left. He only won his home state of Minnesota, and that was it. So moving far to the left has not worked well for the Democrats in the past. Now, of course, there's also the question of, well, has the society changed to such a degree that a more further left candidate would be accepted today that they might not have been back then? I think a case can be made for that due to demographic change, cultural change, generational change, as well as the much wider class divisions that we now have that did not exist in the 1970s, say, or did not exist in the 1980s. We have these much wider class divisions that are becoming a real issue and are being played out in the two parties. Plus, we have certain other changes that might favor a more left-leaning candidate. So ultimately, you know, the big issue is, do the Democrats want to have a corporate Democrat as their standard bearer, or do they want somebody that is identified as being with the left as their standard bearer? And that's going to be dependent, obviously, on how the conflict plays out within their own party.
with pardon me, with the Democrats, it seems as though the DNC, the party apparatus, has a lot of sway and the ability to shut down insurgencies that come from, you know, the leftward fringes. Maybe they have more control than the Republican Party does on the right.
I think they do, because I think that if someone akin to Donald Trump had been the Democratic candidate or trying to be the Democratic candidate in 2016, I think the DNC would have found a better means of shutting them out. Coming from her kind of background, I think would probably be even more objectionable to the Democrats, and I think they would probably go out of their way to ensure somebody like that was not their candidate. A lot of that has to do with not only political divisions, but class divisions among the Democrats. The kinds of corporate Democrats that control the DNC and all of that don't want to have a far-left candidate representing the party, in part because they don't want to have a far-left government. They don't want to have a government that's going to, say, enact high corporate taxes and high income taxes and implement a range of, say, social democratic programs and things of that nature. They tend to be much more conservative on economic issues, in part because that reflects their own class interests. So that's a genuine problem. And, in fact, that's part of the reason why the Democrats are in the position they're in now, because in the 1970s, when the new left went into the Democratic Party, previously the main conflict in the party had been between the corporate Democrats and the labor Democrats. It was a genuine class conflict within the party. Over time, what the corporate Democrats realized is that they could co-opt the cultural left and form an alliance with that against the labor left. For instance, that's why you started to see the Democratic Leadership Council and the neoliberals and groups like that emerge, which, you know, eventually found their fruition in the Clinton administration, where you now had Democrats who were essentially Republicans on everything except social issues. I mean, that's what Bill Clinton was. He was essentially a Republican on everything except abortion and gay rights and race issues and guns and all these kinds of social issues. And you have the neoliberals, and then you have a conflict between them and now the far left. But what's now considered the left wing of the Democratic Party has actually been a relatively recent phenomenon. It largely began around the time of Occupy Wall Street, where you start to see a lot of resurgence of left-type activism, and you start seeing that going into the Democratic Party. Sanders, in particular, was successfully able to pick up on a lot of that and incorporate that into his campaign. So now we're starting to see the growth of a left-wing insurgency in the Democratic Party that hasn't really been there for a while.
You mentioned Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and she wouldn't be a viable candidate in 2020. She technically won't be old enough to run for president until the 2024 election. She's 29 right now.
Yes, well, that's one of the reasons why I said that. I mean, plus just not only her age, but her, you know, her lack of experience and all of that. I don't think she'd be a sellable candidate, you know, on that level.
I agree. You mentioned very early in our conversation when I asked about the polarization in our culture, you talked about technological reasons for it. And I wonder if there is there are economic reasons for it as well. I mean, I'm thinking right now we're in what we're told is a very strong economy, and yet wages are not growing, and there are a lot of people who are still working under very precarious conditions and taking jobs that one would think, you know, in a strong economy, people wouldn't be forced to take.
Well, sure. I think class divisions are a huge part of this, and I think the points you've raised are absolutely right. We're hearing a lot now about how the economy is doing so wonderful, and that usually comes down to two things. It usually comes down to the stock market and unemployment rates, and that's how a lot of mainstream economists and establishment figures measure economic health. If the stock market's doing well and unemployment rates are supposedly low, then what are the problems? But the real measure of economic health from a working class perspective amounts to real wages, living costs, consumption costs, and inflation rates. those are the things that matter from a working class perspective. And we haven't seen any improvement in those areas. Real wages are still stagnant. Living costs are still going up. Wage rates are not keeping up with inflation. And as far as the unemployment rate, we have a relatively low unemployment rate, but the quality and type of employment matters as well. You could theoretically have zero unemployment, but if everybody is working at McDonald's and Walmart and Home Depot and Starbucks, then you still got a problem because those are not jobs on which people can survive in most of the jurisdictions in the United States. So the class divide is there as much as it ever was. If you want to look at some historical precedent, in the 1920s, they call that the Roaring Twenties. One of the reasons they call it the Roaring Twenties is because there was actually a great economic boom in the 1920s, and the people at the top of the socioeconomic ladder did very well, even while the people at the bottom weren't. That was also a time of extreme class polarization, and of course it collapsed at the end of the decade. So the class divisions that we have are real, and they're serious, and they're at an all-time high. And in many ways, I think the elites on both sides of the political spectrum use the cultural issues and the partisan issues as a means of obscuring this. You know, I don't think that the Republican Party, whatever they may think about the Democrats, wants there to be more attention given to class issues. And I think that at least on the leadership of the Democratic Party, I don't think they want more attention given to class issues either. I think that's one of the reasons why they push identity issues to a much greater degree. They focus a lot more on, say, like race and gender and gay rights and perhaps the environment and things like that, as opposed to class issues. And I think that's in part why the Republicans focus so much on immigration and things of that nature, is because of they don't really want to focus on class issues either. But the class issues are there, and those are going to continue to get worse over time because there's no evidence that's actually slowing down, that class divisions are becoming narrower. They're actually becoming wider, and the condition of the working class is actually declining. I mean, labor is becoming re-proletarianized in the United States.
What do you mean by that?
Okay, well, in the historically, the working class and industrial societies, that is of the kind that started to emerge in the 19th century, were very poor. Working classes in industrial societies have always been very poor, just like peasants and agrarian agricultural societies were always very poor. What happened is that in the mid 20th century, the level of economic development and technological development as well grew, and also there were a range of political and economic and legal and social reforms that were implemented that in many of the more developed countries allowed the working class to essentially achieve the standard of living of a middle class. A lot of Americans think of as the middle class is really a working class, but it's a... For a time, at least, it was the largest and most prosperous working class, or the largest number of people with a middle-class standard of living in history. If you look at the period of the United States between, say, 1950 up through the 1980s, that's what you see. You see this period of several decades where the United States had the largest middle class in history and where the working class was essentially living a middle-class lifestyle. And better than many previous middle classes because of technological developments and things like that. But that has started to decline significantly in the era of neoliberalism and in the era of globalization and all of these kinds of things. Starting with Reaganomics back in the 1980s and then neoliberalism under Bill Clinton and everything that's happened since then, we've seen the position of the working class in the United States in particular decline. To a lesser degree, it's happening in other advanced industrial technological societies, but in the United States, it's been particularly significant, and that's why we see the widening class divisions. Now, when I say we're becoming reproletarianized, when proletarianism was just the term for the impoverished masses of workers that came out of the Industrial Revolution, it's a Marxist term, but you don't have to be a Marxist to recognize this, But what we're seeing now is the working class in the United States is less and less working in jobs that they're going to be able to have a middle-class standard of living, certainly not with any kind of security. And more the working class is working in service industry jobs, low-wage jobs that are of a temporary nature. For instance, it's not uncommon to find a lot of working people now who have three or four part-time jobs, none of which provide things like health care benefits or retirement benefits or disability or anything like that beyond just the bare minimum that's required by the state, like workman's comp and some of those kinds of things. So we're starting to see more and more people working in these kinds of jobs, and meanwhile the cost of living, particularly housing prices have really become exorbitant, particularly in large cities in recent years. So this has the effect of reproletarianizing the working class, where the working class is working for low wages, longer hours, worse conditions, less benefits, and a higher cost of living.
We are on live radio right now, and just about everybody listening is in the United States. But tomorrow I'll put this up as a podcast, and people will be listening to it in the UK and in Australia and even in Japan and China. I'd like to invite you in our closing moments here to address some of the themes of this past hour's conversation, but maybe bring in some examples that would be more of interest to an international audience.
Well, a similar process is unfolding in other countries that are at least the ones that are similar to the United States. If we look at the nations around the world that are similar to the United States, that is Europe and Australia, New Zealand, the Oceania region, we're starting to see similar things happen in the sense that we're starting to see the rise of both a left and a right-wing populism that is challenging the neoliberal consensus. The neoliberal economic consensus has existed in the Western world, predominantly meaning the countries that I just mentioned, plus a few others, for decades now. And now we're starting to actually see the effects of that. Part of it was the recession that happened 10 years ago, but then we've also started to see other lingering effects of neoliberal policies of different kinds. And what's starting to happen now is the neoliberal consensus that elites have subscribed to for decades is being challenged from both the left and from the right. In America, we've seen the rise of Trumpism from the right and Bernie Sandersism from the left. But we're seeing that in England with the rise of Brexit and with the rise of Corbyn from the left. We're seeing this in France with the rise of the Front National, and also from there was a challenge from the far left recently as well. We're seeing this in Germany. We're starting to see the rise of left populism tendencies, as well as the rise of right-wing nationalism, like Alternatives for Deutschland and some of those groups. We're seeing this all throughout the developed world. We're starting to see a challenge to the neoliberal consensus from both the left and the right. The big question is, what will be the future of that? There was a very interesting article written by a far-left person, a Marxist, who is something of an Antifa type in recent. I won't say that. I'll say he's like a left anti-fascist. This fellow seems to be a Marxist with some far-left leanings, at least. But there was a very interesting analysis by this writer named Don Hammerquist recently, where he points out what I think is correct, and that is that what is happening is that the neoliberal elites are essentially trying to co-opt left-wing populism to attack right-wing populism in the name of defending democracy and liberalism against right-wing authoritarianism and fascism. And that's why we see in the Western media, and with the exception of the partisan right-wing media like Fox News in the United States, but we're starting to see more and more leaders like Trump or Marine Le Pen or Orban in Hungary, or the new Polish government. We're starting to see them being attacked by the elites as fascist, as a threat to democracy. We're starting to see Russia attacked as somehow rigging Western elections and installing far right figures. This, I think, represents an element by an aspect of neoliberalism strategy. Neoliberalism is trying to co-opt left-wing populism in order to attack right-wing populism, thereby deflecting and defusing all populism and maintaining its own position. The question is, will the elite be able to successfully co-opt opposition movements from the left? Will they be able to control and contain opposition movements to the right? Will these efforts generate even more radical tendencies? Will the populist right actually go towards something that more closely resembles fascism? Will the populist left resist efforts to be co-opted and go even further left towards actual socialism or actual communism or something like that? I'm very skeptical as to whether hardcore extremists are going to gain real power and influence the way they did in the aftermath of World War I. I think that's very unlikely. But I do think that this is an interesting situation where the neoliberal consensus in the developed countries is collapsing, and we're seeing the rise of the populist right and the populist left, and the neoliberal class is trying to respond in this particular way, and it remains to be seen how that will turn out.
Well, we are going to have to leave it there because we've got just over a minute left in the hour. But your response to Don Hammarquist is the top item on your website right now. The website is attackthesystem.com, and that story is called A Marxist View of the Capitalist Co-option of the Populist Left, which is kind of a mouthful to say, particularly on live radio, but communicates a lot. Keith Preston, I find our conversations very useful, so thank you so much for coming back to the Sea Realm radio show.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Have a good day.
Likewise.
All righty. Again, that was Keith Preston of Attack the System, and you have been listening to Sea Realm Radio, which is an outgrowth of the long-running Sea Realm podcast. You can find hundreds of hours of Sea Realm podcast conversations on my website. It is crealm.com. That is the letter C, which stands for consciousness, and then a dash, and then R-E-A-L-M, crealm.com. My email address is kmo@crealm.com. All right, that's all for this episode of Sea Realm Radio. Thanks for listening. I will talk to you again in 1 week's time.
On the Sea Realm podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, to its old dimensions.
All right, that was Keith Preston, and a nice thing about hearing from Keith Preston is I don't have to push him in this direction at all. This is just his inclination, his modus operandi, is to look at things from a historical perspective and say not what Democrats are or what Republicans are, but where they came from, how they got to be the way they are right now, which emphasizes the fact that the way they are right now isn't really the way they are at all. It is just the current manifestation of an ever-evolving form. Throw in a little probabilistic thinking and maybe just a few E-prime exercises from time to time, and you're well on your way to escaping the mind trap of Aristotelian logic. Not that logic isn't darned useful. It is. But you just have to keep limber to avoid a hardening of the categories. All right, I will not linger here at the end, except to say, hey, I do a weekly comic strip, and I know that more people listen to this podcast than check out the comic strip, and I would like to increase the number of people who look at the comic strip. You can find it at geb.io. That is G-E-B-B, Golf Echo Bravo Bravo .io. As I'm sure you've heard me say, the comic strip is about a group of aliens who think that the work that they do, kidnapping humans, giving them anal probes, is absolutely ridiculous, particularly given the ecological situation on Earth that requires action, and these aliens are part of a vast alien bureaucracy that seems to be in no way interested in taking meaningful action, at least not in a timely fashion, again, given what's at stake. But, as always, things are not what they appear. I hope you will check it out. I get very little feedback on the comic so far, and I would like to change that. So again, check it out. It is at geb.io, and I post links to it in all of my social media feeds, which you can find, on the social media platforms. All right. Again, not lingering here at the end of the podcast. Thanks for listening. I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.